Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, makers of specialty cheese from Switzerland, crafted with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmiusa.com. That's emmiusa.com.
Welcome to Pizza Quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt, a man on a never-ending search for the perfect pizza. This show is the audio version of the Pizza Talk YouTube series, where I engage in interesting conversations with some of the country's greatest pizza makers and other artisans. Thanks for joining me on this quest. Hello, welcome to a new episode of Pizza Talk. I'm Peter Reinhardt, and I'm here today with Vanessa Kimball. You know, we talk a lot about pizza on this site, but really underlying all of that is my passion and love for bread. And Vanessa is now one of the most important voices in the bread world, not only because of her books, which includes this most recent one, the 10 Minute Sourdough. I've got the Sourdough School Sweet Baking and the Sourdough School. These are kind of this trilogy of books that are like a master course in everything you want to know about sourdough baking. And sourdough is kind of your thing. I mean, that's what you're known for, Vanessa, and your community, your sourdough school, is reaching people all over the world. So I want to talk briefly about how all that came about and a little bit of your background. And then I want to really dig into something that excites me about your work, which is the research you're doing about the wellness possibilities, you know, what sourdough can do for our gut and for our mental health as well. And so I think that's kind of, right now, I think the next frontier for all of us is okay, we love sourdough. A lot of people got into sourdough during the pandemic, but really, where is it leading us and what are the implications of not only that, but your work? So, Vanessa, welcome and thanks for joining us from the center of England. You're right there, you know, right in, for our listeners, why don't you tell us where you're coming from?
No, so I'm upstairs in my study. I've got probably close on about 2,000 books in here on bread, and a lot of them going back nearly 500 years. So I'm surrounded by a legacy of bakers. I'm just one in a long line.
Right, it is a long lineage, but you're, like I said, in the center of England. For just to situate you for everyone else, whereabouts in England?
So we're in rural Northamptonshire. But if you want to kind of situate it in your head, we are exactly an hour north of London and smack between Oxford and Cambridge. So as far as I'm concerned, we're in the center of the universe. Right,
the center of the universe, really. Yeah. And again, talk about long heritages. You know, you've got not only the bread heritage, but the access to really intellectual knowledge for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years. So, but what we know you for now is sourdough, the sourdough school and everything else you've done. So tell us a little bit about that and how you got there. I mean, you didn't just start out as a baker.
No, I pretty much did, actually. I'm the daughter of an Italian chef who was baking in the 1960s. I'm fourth generation baker. My great grandmother's owned a bakery in Italy. And my other grandmother, both sides actually, my other grandmother was a baker in just up north. She was famous actually for her cakes, particularly for her christening and wedding cakes, renowned in her area. And her name was Lillian, actually, very lovely, really teaching me to bake from a time I could stand up and hold a spoon. And I trained, as she started baking sourdough, I'm coming up now for my 50th this year, which is kind of cool. And I'm just a fraction away from being 40 years of since I first baked sourdough.
So you've been doing it since you're about 10 years old.
Yeah, I'm just slightly old. I was actually 11 when my parents would let me climb out of the window in the house in Southwest France where I was brought up. And I would shimmy down the window in the middle of the night. I used to think it was the bread that woke me up, but it was actually the oak smoke that would wind its way into my bedroom, which was literally behind my bedroom was behind the bakery. And I'd run down the alleyway about 2 o'clock in the morning, without any real thought whether I was allowed to or not. And I would sort of throw myself in, because it's quite terrifying to run down a dark alleyway or two at that age. And I sort of throw myself into the bakery, literally thinking that some, you know, demon was running after me. I must have really wanted to go in. And I was allowed to help. And that is how I fell in love with baking and why I ended up doing what we call in the UK 706 1 and 2 professional catering studies, which means I trained for as a chef and a baker. That was how you trained in those days. And then I went on to Southwest France to do an apprenticeship. I was actually a year younger than I should have been. So I was 18, 19 doing an apprenticeship in the Dordogne with the uncle of the now owner of the bakery that I grew up baking in. And sometimes you see me on social media, I pop back to the bakeries. I did it a couple of years ago, and it's like being, you know, like being a child again in there. I love it.
Really back to your childhood roots. So though you live and mostly are, you know, British, your roots go back to Southwest France. So that's where you really kind of.
You know, we've got a cross of Italian heritage, French, and obviously, you know, I like to say French style, English manners, and Italian passion.
That's good, and that comes together for us, and the outcome is we get some good eating out of all of that, but also some good learning, because then you kind of take in all your knowledge and are becoming a teacher of others and helping spread and using the internet as a way to reach a much wider audience than just the surrounding area.
I'm not really sure that I actually really do teach people to make bread, actually. I'm not sure that's, if you bring me down to what I actually do, I'm not teaching people to bake bread. I'm actually teaching people to connect. And it's a means of systems challenge. It's a way of, I'm what you call a tempered moderate or a tempered moderate anarchist. I have very little interest in what most people consider to be the thing that gets the biggest round of applause in sourdough, which is big holes. And I get big holes. If I didn't, nobody would be following me. And I've got probably near on now, across all social media, about 500,000 followers.
That's substantial, yeah.
It's quite impressive. But the big holes are what people applaud, but actually understanding systems and how they impact our health, and actually understanding the flaws in the system, then providing a solution for systems change that can improve the way that we feel about the world we live in and essentially live a better life. That's actually what I teach. And it just happens that we evolved with bread and I evolved with bread, and bread is the means that I communicate to get people to they themselves become, I guess, food activists in the most beautiful way possible. So I can turn someone into a food activist on a daily basis and challenge systems that are deeply flawed, improve their health, and get people to cognitively challenge the accepted flawed system. And actually, as my form of activism, I gather people and get them on board. So it's a cult, really.
A bread cult.
Yeah.
And so bread is not only your craft, but it's also your metaphor, it sounds like. I mean, it's the hook that leads to a much deeper sense of purpose and mission than just baking, even though you also seem to be extremely passionate and committed to the baking side, to the quality of bread. Whether you say big holes, small holes, it's really about flavor and it's about delivering the best possible quality of bread.
I think that's a given. I almost think that when I read people in a recipe and they say this bread is delicious, I'm almost rolling my eyes like, well, yeah, duh. If it's not, why is this a recipe you bothered to share? It's a given that it's delicious. And yeah. I think that that tacit knowledge that I have that's ingrained in me, it's almost, I don't actually really remember learning to bake because I don't remember learning to walk or to talk. So I guess it's been one of those things that's in me on a level that I don't really have to think about it. So I imagine that when that's so much part of my understanding of bread being delicious, my interest is what the impact that bread has on you.
Yeah.
And physically and mentally, and that's really where my research came in, Peter.
And that's kind of a new phase of your life now is this, you're doing doctoral work now to pursue the wellness implications of sourdough fermentation, if I'm understanding it correctly, if I'm saying correctly what it is that you're doing.
Yeah, I'm about 16 weeks away now from handing my doctorate in, and I've got I'm not allowed to swear, am I really, on podcast? So I'm a baker, I've got tattoos, attitudes, and I swear. So let's have a think about this. It's an awful lot of work.
Yeah. And where is it leading? Okay, so you've done a lot of work, you know, kind of bringing together these various threads of your life. And I want to back up and talk a little bit about what some of the findings that you've come up with in your research and in your mm-hmm. in your thesis work. And then hopefully we can spend some time talking about, okay, where ultimately is this going to lead us? Is if we're trying to change systems, and not just the baking systems and bread making systems, but really it sounds like you're talking about changing the world and the systems and the way we view the world. I don't know if there is such a thing as a moderate anarchist or a temperate anarchist, but if there is such a one, then I guess what you're trying to say is we want to get there without drawing too much attention to ourselves and getting thrown in jail. But at the same time, but we want to make change. We really want to affect change. And so let's talk about that change first. What kind of change are you looking for?
So I think that it's fair to say that I am the sort of girl who would strap myself to an oil rig. And I'm the sort of girl who has and would get myself arrested. So let's be very clear.
Yeah.
Right. You're
more than just moderate.
I temper my anarchism. I think everybody who really knows me understands that.
Okay.
I think that yelling and shouting that a system is broken just puts people off. And I think that at the second that you start really, really talking about, and occasionally I do, but I do it because I know that a little bit of this will get attention, but I don't actually use it very often. So when we start talking about sliced white death and the fact that some of the bread system and that refined carbohydrate and the emulsifiers and some of the things that have been put in there are essentially poisoning slowly but surely, on the same way that smoking, we understood smoking did. We're now in a situation where 2 years into a pandemic, when we start pushing back against the research, we suddenly start to understand that the composition of the gut microbiome, the balance of those microbes in the gut, interplay with the way our immune system reacts. And I won't go into detail, but let's just say that the gut and the balance of the gut and those positive microbes actually moderate, it's a good word, I've used it several times today, that actually moderate your immune system response. In other words, we're learning that a good balanced, healthy gut will have less of a response to COVID. So we know now, we've understood now that we've got this, we're beginning really, we're right at the beginning of understanding how our gut is a central player in health and how it's central to all and connected to all of the other systems in our body. Mm-hmm. And it regulates inflammation. When you start and understand, like myself, I had very, very low gut microbial diversity. my diversity when it was tested by Professor Tim Spector, who's basically the Mick Jagger of the gut microbiome. I'm very fond of him, and I know he will laugh when I say that.
Now that's a great image.
Yeah, he's just a cool guy. And he tested my gut, and my diversity when I, in 2016, was less than 2% diversity, which is lower than an autistic child. So I had a gut microbial diversity that I actually think several of the world's leading gut microbiome specialists looked at my results and essentially called me a walking miracle. They couldn't actually even get their heads around the fact that I was in health. And that is because 30 years ago, I discovered that the only way I could actually eat and remain feeling well was to ferment everything. And I was fermenting stuff a little bit like Sandal Katz. He similarly did a lot of work understanding that by pre-digesting his food, he was facilitating health, more bioavailability of minerals, higher nutritional value. And like him, I actually, out of almost necessity, I was eating almost everything fermented, and that in turn is probably what essentially saved me. So you could almost say sourdough saved my life.
Well, let me just go back for one thing. You said that when you were tested, you had low diversity of microorganisms in your gut. Is that what they found? And is that is it the goal to have much higher diversity? Do we want high diversity as opposed to losing?
No, the wider the diversity of your gut microbiome, the more robust your health. Okay, so you're actually looking for the widest diversity possible. And the microbes in your gut, it's incredible. They're just amazing. And I could talk for 45 minutes without stopping just on the microbes. But there are some microbes that they manufacture the metabolites needed for your brain to function. So if you don't have what you need, i.e. fiber, diversity of microbes in your gut, and then actually deliver that fiber, then it's quite conceivable, and we're learning that this is connected to the way your brain functions and to mental health. Mm-hmm. Likewise, we are discovering that we evolve with fermentation, and that evolution was unpicked through industrializing the system. And if you can go along the industrial system, and at every point from the agricultural practices through to monoculture, through to the milling process, then the lack of fermentation process and simply using yeast, and then adding in emulsifiers that actually ruin the lining of your gut, they're damaging and cause dysbiosis, which in turn causes inflammation, which is associated with disease. We're suddenly realizing that we have actually disconnected ourselves from the process that we evolve with that makes us function correctly. And when we do that, we're seeing the results right here in front of us, in front of our eyes. We're seeing non-communicable illnesses. We're seeing depression. We see it in the children around us. We see anxiety. We see cancers, obesity, Alzheimer's, all sorts of, rheumatoid arthritis.
Would you say there's a connection also to learning disabilities and challenges for learning?
The learning disabilities, not so much, but certainly cognitive diseases. So Alzheimer's, I think, is one of the third biggest killers in the UK, especially of women. Bowel cancer, lack of fiber again. Again, this is, the thing is, Peter, the research is there. It's just sitting in this incredible bank of knowledge that has been produced. And my job was to take the knowledge and essentially not devolve the system, because we've done that ourselves. And we can't recreate the same bread that we evolved with, because we wouldn't accept it as food these days. Our jaws probably wouldn't be able to chew it. It would be unpalatable to us. And it probably has got the odd sort of stone thrown in with it to break our teeth. So we don't want to go back to sort of, you know, Neolithic bread or even sort of medieval bread. But we need to understand our own look at our own evolution. And then what I did with my studies and my, we call it our bread protocol here at the Sado School, is I've had 10 years of putting together a protocol. And then I was very lucky because I was sponsored to test it. I will say a lot of people have a lot of misgivings about sponsorship, and Stefan and Carl and Piratos actually put some money behind my studies. And they never once asked anything of me other than just push the, they really participated in it, but they've never once compromised me. I did warn them. I was like, don't even ask for a compromise, because yeah, right, you're not getting it.
If you're going to champion me, then let me do my thing and don't tell me what
to... so I took 12 people, willing volunteers. Apparently I'm not allowed to call them guinea pigs anymore because it's not politically correct to do that. So they weren't guinea pigs. I did test their gut microbiome. We took a really good look at what was inside, along with Dr. Miguel Matas, who's our research director at the Sado School, and Dr. Alexandra Davidson. And I was very lucky to be joined by Dr. Elizabeth Phillips as well, who's a neuroscientist. She specializes in cognitive as well as CPD. And CBD, sorry. And we actually, we fed them according to the bread protocol. And in order to do that, I'll come back to what the bread protocol is. We fed them for between 200 and 300 grams of the bread a day, and it didn't have to be bread. It actually had to just be the way that we eat the bread, including the flour. And then we retested their gut microbiome. And one of the things that I did was my background is actually my degree is in psychology of human communication. I have a mentor, Professor David Veal, who helped me to design single case study design. So each person then acted as their own control. And we did a pilot study. We're still putting some more work in before we publish that. I'll be doing that hopefully with David Veal in King's College London. But I've got to get through the next bit of the doctorate first. And essentially we observed the physiological changes in the gut and their ability to produce something called butyric acid, which is like, I mean think of it as being like a kind of butyric being buttery slime around the inside the digestive system. It's food home for the microbes. It's a good thing. It's what we want to see. And we look for increased levels of butyric acid, which we had, and an increase in the balance of the positive microbes, and particularly things like bifidobacterium that then produce the metabolites that are needed by the brain. And what we were looking for, we saw. I mean, there was absolutely no doubt whatsoever. There were increases in key microbes as part of what we saw when we tested them 12 weeks later. But I was actually more interested, though, I mean, the physiological changes is actual, you know, there's your evidence. But yeah. Evidence to me, I was far more interested in the mood score and the self-scoring based on what people had said that they were having trouble with. So during the course of the study, we had individuals who lost weight, who felt satiated. We had someone who had been a chronic insomniac who started sleeping through the night. And we looked at the pathways of, you know, how the bread did that. That's part of what I teach, is exploring how that happens. We had people whose cholesterol lowered. And I think to say it's fermentation alone would be, I don't like an isolationist system, Peter. It doesn't work for me. So we also teach how you eat the bread, not, you know, right down to looking at strains, not for this study, but for what I teach, we'll look down to strain specific bacteria and the studies. But we saw in every person who we got 9 through the study, in all 9 people, we were like, well, if this was a pharmaceutical pill somebody would be like, ding, ding, ding. But the problem we've got is that the system is set up for us to fail, because the real money, when you start looking at it, is in us being sick, not well. Okay. So the money is in cheap food that gives profit for the conglomerates and these big organizations. And the other end of the money is actually in the pharmaceutical industry that is propping us up with, you know, heart, you know, cholesterol medicine, statins, and anti-inflammatory. And this is where it comes into me being sort of this dissidence about and the anarchists. I really do not like to see people living their lives being completely unaware of the system they're living in, which is actually almost by design set up to make them live a life that is compromised, and I won't compromise. So
it's really about consciousness raising as well as providing a pathway to health and wellness. You gotta wake people up first before you can get them to
absolutely. and Beautiful Bread is a way of doing that. So just run you back to the bread protocol.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure everyone wants to know about that, because now you're saying, okay, there actually is a pathway. So yeah, we'd love to hear more about that protocol.
The protocol itself is actually right under your nose. It's that I wrote it out for you to see the outline of it. It's in that Sweet Sourdough School book. I think it's page, I should know the page. It's page 30 something. It's a black page. So you can actually see it there in front of you.
Okay.
Obviously it's slightly more detailed than that. But it's in essence, Peter, one of the major parts of the protocol obviously is fermentation, but it's not the first part of it. The first part is diversity. And in order to go back to diversity, we had to reimagine what flour is. And we created a range in that book. You can see them. I haven't hidden my knowledge. So you can see, we call them botanical blends. And we mill the whole meadow blends. So our first blend is called Meadow Blend. And we mill the whole meadow.
This is the one, the page that I'm on, where it talks about the seven powerful ways. Is that where I'm in the right spot?
So that's the structure of the bread protocol. I mean, there's a little more to it, but nothing that isn't right there on the page. You only get a certain amount of stuff you can write in a book. You get edited out, but yeah.
So if I'm understanding again correctly, and this is one of your books, this is the one called The Sourdough School Sweet Baking, correct?
That's the one.
And then the subtitle, Nourishing the Gut and the Mind. So again, not forgetting that this is really the deeper mission of all this work. I mean, everyone's loving to make the sourdough bread, but it's leading to something even more important than just eating good bread. So here's the seven powerful ways that you identify: increase fiber, mm-hmm. increase diversity, meaning the mm-hmm. microbiome organisms, ferment, increase levels of antioxidants, mm-hmm. increase probiotics in your bakes, reduce refined sugar, and make lifestyle changes that support the body as a whole. So that's the general categories. And then in between, then you explain more in depth in the book how you do all those things.
Each one of these is its own, it could be its own chapter. And of course you run out, the publishers are like, come on, get on with the recipe.
So
the reality is that probably the key system change within that protocol is in the diversity flour. So when we mill our flour, and we have this in production with Hobmedods in the UK, we have Nick and Josiah, who are the co-founders of Hobmedods, which is a support. It's almost like a cooperative where you we've created the meadow blend. We mill nettles and rose petals and wild oregano and barley and oats and rye.
These are all milled with the wheat itself, is what you're saying.
Yeah, here. I mean, this is flour. You have to just get your head around it. Flour is not Triticum mastivitum or Triticum monococcum, or, you know, it's actually, if flour is not monoculture. What we've all bought into, it's quite ironic, Peter. Here we are. Most bakers are sourdough bakers who are baking are often challenging the system. They've already recognized that the system needs changing and they've gone to sourdough, but they buy straight in without question into an agricultural system that is actually deeply flawed. You've got an agricultural system that is the seeds are actually being controlled by the conglomerates of who can grow them. It's a system that is actually, we've apparently got only 50 crops left according to some doomsayers, but, you know, whatever you want to think on that. We've got an agricultural system that actually draws out of the soil without pushing back, using agrochemicals, fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides into the food that we eat, including ones that we know actually have a negative impact on the gut microbiome. We know this. We have no diversity within our agricultural systems. And then you see a baker, you know, thumping the air with his, you know, spelt loaf. And I'm like, mate, this is not systems challenge. You just got hooked in. Straight in, you need to go right under the system, look at it as if it's the very first time you've looked at it, and see the connection between the need of the gut microbiome for diversity, the need of our planet to survive for diversity, and actually stop auto-accepting that what we are given by the industrial system, even the small producers, are not thinking out of the box. We have to get out of the box that they put us in, and that is diversity bred, botanical blend flour, and looking at how we evolved to use the what was already given and gifted to us by being on the planet, and actually think. And what I actually do is get people to think with their hands, their hearts, their minds, while sharing the most beautiful bread in the world with their friends, the people they love. If that isn't the most, that's changing the whole paradigm of bread. And in doing so, what I actually do here is I work with big industry. So you know them, Peter. I mean, you know, we're looking at systems change within that, with these concepts. I teach the doctors here. We have the courses are accredited by the Royal College of General Practitioners. So the doctors I treat here go away from the course being able to prescribe the bread making course to their patients free of charge. We're a social enterprise. And I also allow we have a lot of bakers on the course as well who are like, I'm in. And we actually, so we work with artisan bakers, we work with the medical industry, and we work with big bread industry.
Industrial bakers,
Well, that's so that's a big change.
That's a huge get if you can get them on board. You mentioned as one of your sponsors is Puratos, who's a company I'm familiar with. They are a huge international company of baking products. And of course, many people know them in our world, in the bread world, as the creators of the sourdough library in Belgium, where they house about 125 or 30 historic sourdough starters, and they analyze them and everything else. So they have a huge investment in sourdough as again a solution. I think this is important because you're trying to reach companies that are in the system that's broken and get them to try to wake up to a different way of going. We had Glenn Roberts on the show a while back, and he talks about the perfect acre of land is one that grows what he calls polycrop, polycrop grains. It's wheat and rye. It's all different things. It could be beans, legumes, flowers. What I'm hearing you say is it's the same thing. It's a botanical flower. When you harvest all those grains from a polycrop acre, which means it's better for the land. It's better for the crops can grow together without artificial fertilizers or chemicals. They protect each other. And you get a totally diverse type of flower that is unlike anything we've seen. And it's still a very small scale. But now you're talking about how to make it big scale. So how does this botanical flower become available to our listeners, for instance, or to?
I was talking to the millers this morning, and it's already in production. It's already being used all over England. It's that system's already in place.
So mainly in the UK, would you say, or is it happening over here in the United States?
No, we've had preliminary discussions. It hasn't gone any further, mainly because I've been probably, there's only one of me and I have to just.
Well, that's it. We need a whole army of people like you, you know, driving. It can't be just a one person show or you'll wear out, you know, and that's what Sourdough School is all about, is creating that community of people to kind of push forward in all of this.
I think in the end, I think when you realize that, you know, a lot of what I do is invisible, in the sense that I've been doing this so long that I hear phrases that I kind of invented, spoken back, nobody knows where they came from. And yeah. I remember thinking for hours, what should I call something? Or how should I phrase something? Should it be this or that? And then I see pieces of you know, couple of decades of my work coming back at me via social media. It's quite interesting,
let me just jump in here for a second. We're going to take a little break because with our the way we record, we have to stop and reload the camera, so to speak. Yep. So why don't we take a quick break here? We'll come back and just finish up this conversation. I know your time is limited, so I want to get the kernel of everything you're saying. So I'm going to invite our listeners to just join us in the next segment, and we're going to take a little break. Vanessa and I will take a little break, and our team will reload, and we're going to start up again and continue where we're leaving off. So we're speaking with Vanessa Kimball. She's coming to us from the heart of England, and we're talking about really basically changing the world one baker and one loaf at a time. We'll be back.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, makers of specialty cheese from Switzerland, crafted with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of Swiss Gruyere in the United States. But that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kaltbach Cave Age cheeses, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmiusa.com. That's emmiusa.com.
So we're back with Vanessa Kimball on Pizza Talk and Pizza Quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt, and where we left off was Vanessa was giving us a deep dive into the work she's doing. A lot of it is captured in this particular book, one of her three books on sourdough from the Sourdough School. This one's the Sourdough School Sweet Baking, in which she gives really much more explanations of the protocol for how to eat in a way that promotes health and helps us to kind of break free from the systems that have dominated our eating lives. Maybe we'll do a quick recap of that, and then we want to talk a little bit about some applications for this in real life. Because again, your first book of this series is the Sourdough. Let me see, Sourdough School. It's the third one, the new one, 10-Minute Sourdough. Subtitles, always the subtitles are always more interesting sometimes than the main title. Bread Making for Real Life. So we want to make sure that we, you know, we're not talking about something that's so esoteric, but how to make this real and practical for all of us. So Vanessa, again, welcome back. And I'm not even sure where we left off. I know we were talking about the diversity was the key word I kept hearing in what's powerful about what you're doing and the effect it's having on people's moods, on their ability to sleep better, to be healthier, to be more fortified against things like pandemics and illnesses. And it all stems from, it seems to me, from eating a diverse diet that is also fermented. Is it, are these two things kind of hand in glove, would you say?
I think that you can't really separate them. Again, it's a bit like saying, well, I want to separate the yeast and the bacteria. I think that it's trying to slice up the system into one concept doesn't work. So, and just looking at the books there, Peter, I don't know if you've got the original Sourdough School one. That yeah. one, when I was writing it, I was doing the research, and it is actually to nourish the gut. I mean, it was very specific, and that's the one. I mean, that's got the bread recipes in that. I mean, I don't know if you want to open it and see if people can have a little look, but that's actually got the application of the knowledge in. Reality is that to pick up the whole protocol, you actually need the trilogy there. I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, but I wanted to write it as one book, but it got so heavy. I think they were the publisher's like, no, you need to cut this up. But it's actually the secret, the big secret of, look at that. Sorry, I'll be quiet for a second. Show the book, Peter. It's lovely.
I know that one, that last shot. Let me see. I just passed by a page that, and it somehow flew by me. Well, here's again, this is the first book in the series that introduces the ideas. And we talk a lot about the gut microbiome. This is a concept that we've been talking about throughout this conversation. And it's really what it's all about. It seems like healthy gut is healthy life. And
so that was 2015-16. I was actually putting that together, and I just had a gut microbiome transplant. So I was
beautiful loaf there.
That's the one page 127. That's the Russian rye.
It's great that you can actually remember the pages that you saw. that's a loaf of Russian rye bread that again kind of meets the protocol, you know, and this is what you're teaching people at the Sourdough School, which is really, what would you say, a web-based community of people that meet regularly or how would you just define what Sourdough School is?
So we moved away from doing weekly lessons, which I had been doing for a decade. I got frustrated because I was repeating very basic knowledge, and I have one of those, I have an ability to translate very complex academic knowledge into something you can eat.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, it's a very, I'm a translator. And so, and explain it so people get it. And that's the secret. And I get excited about it. So I'm, you know, I never tire of taking this bread out of the oven. And I never tire of that moment where it's the antithesis of life. I mean, at the moment we have these stress hormones, which are cortisol. And we have a principle here that I teach people as they walk in the door, and that is you bake to. And you bake two, you share one. And just that alone, the pathway for that produces a relaxation hormone, which is oxytocin. So even just by sharing your bread, you are actually, there's a pathway in there that we were designed to share what we bake. And so when you're baking, most people, Peter, are not baking for themselves. They're baking for their friends, their family, the people they love. Yeah. People will come in and tell me they're baking for their daughter or their son or their husband or their neighbor. And it's a form of expression, of affection, of connection, and of really managing to demonstrate with baking that they care, and that they that enough to connect the microbes on themselves, their own hands, in the food, and take the time to create something and gift. And that knowledge that I have in my head is designed to be taken and gifted to the world. That's what I do. And I suppose we've been looking at how I measure success as part of you know, the questions that are asked in your doctorate are quite deep sometimes. And I've never measured by financial success. I've been very lucky to have a husband and a family who support what I do. I don't have to work. Mm-hmm. So I've been able to make massive compromises because of being supported by an incredible husband who really holds me up in order to do this. And
because he believes in what you're doing.
He knows that he gets the best version of me, and that without this, my sense of purpose, my true north isn't met, and I don't make a very good wife anymore. So he doesn't get much choice, I suppose. But
so it's a win-win.
Yeah, no, it's good. He gets to eat good bread and meet amazing people. But
and you get to be doing what you love to do.
Yeah, and that change. I mean, it's the most beautiful anarchy. You know, what are you doing if you're not connecting to the soil, to the farmer, to the process, to your friends, to and understand how that impacts your gut and how that's that sweet Saturday school, but will explain right down to which microbes are numbing on that particular, you know, it will tell you, look, you know, here's your hemicellulose, or here's your inulin within the bread, or here's your ferulic acid, and your lactobacillus are munching on it, your plantarum are munching on it, your acromantia are munching on it. I will tell you, because I'm, you know, that geeky, what you've got and who's munching on which part of your bread and what metabolites they're producing for your brain. If you're that geeky, if not, you can flip past that and go straight to the recipes.
You'll take people as deep down the rabbit hole as they're willing to go.
As far as you can go, right down to postbiotics and strain specific. I'm afraid that autistic trait that came. I have autistic traits, and I was diagnosed as high functioning ADHD not so long ago. I have with that low gut microbial diversity. I'm afraid, you know, I don't have a filter, which makes me.
Let me ask about that, your own personal gut biome diversity. Since creating this protocol, if you were measured, does your gut now produce a more diverse array of biotics?
So I was offered by one of the, I mean, it would have probably cost something between about £6,000 and £7,000, but I was offered to be part of a study for a gut microbial transplant back in 2016. So
that's a scary term right there.
It's special. Yeah, I know. And, you know, I've had three children. Nothing phases me. Yeah. I sat outside in the car for a few minutes having a complete meltdown. And I sometimes get a little bit nervous, and I was, but yeah. I figured I knew the implications of having low gut microbial diversity. It's a shorter life. And it's not being able to make what I needed. And I knew that was what was going on in me, and I was aware of that. And so I now know that I have 12 of the UK's finest firefighters, gut microbiome.
Yes.
And that we're, so don't give me a hose. I will spray you down. If there's a fire, I'm obviously going to save everyone. Or if your cat's stuck up a tree, I could probably help. We lifted and changed my gut microbial diversity from 2% to just about 70% diversity, which is absolutely phenomenal.
What was the number?
2% wow. to 70%. So 68% increase in diet. I mean, that takes me above the average British person. I'm grateful. The people that did that were, you know, they themselves are slightly strange people, and they've asked me never to discuss about them. So I can talk about my own transplant, but they didn't want to be named. But they are a clinic. Wow. And they're pushing, I mean, legally, you know, it's very, you know, you push, there are another lots of people who are pushing boundaries, because we ourselves are devolving. You take antibiotics, you take lack of fiber, you take stress, you take monoculture, you put that into the mix, you take that third, fourth, fifth generation of antibiotics, and our gut microbiome that would have originally been, Tim Spector and some very interesting people have been out to see the Hansa tribe, tested their gut, and they are the closest thing that we would get to looking at ourselves maybe 200 years ago. And we are devolving. And what would have been averagely 100% diversity, if you take a hunter-gatherer tribe, is having a 100% diversity. The average person is now about 50% diversity. Now, when you look at what job they do and how the importance of it, especially in protecting the gut lining and creating the butyric acid that protects your tuna sandwich from getting past your gut lining inside of you, you know, your immune system, when you have a compromised gut, is absolutely freaking out. Like the Starship Enterprise, it's like, you know, there's an intruder on board. Woo, woo, woo. And it goes in. It's like, you know, this is an attack by your lunch, you know, tuna sandwich, or and the proteins are seen by your body is an enemy, and then it starts attacking them. But your body can be a little bit clumsy, a little bit like setting off a load of soldiers with machine guns. The bullets spray, they're wide, and this often translates into low-grade inflammation, and yes, and it can be prevented so easily. And the fermentation itself facilitates more bioavailability of the fiber in vitro that actually translates then into that butyric acid. That's what your microbes munch on and turn into engine oil, like, you know, that then stops it. It's a barrier. It's also butyric acid is associated with lower levels of inflammation, lower levels of cancer.
Right.
And the simplest solution is, to start with, bread protocol number one is to deliver more fiber. Then we start looking at fermentation.
Right.
So actually we start with fiber and diversity is next. And then we go to fermentation, which kind of unlocks all the nutrients, but simultaneously reduces the gluten load, specifically reducing gliadin and damaging the protein, so the immune system doesn't recognize it as an enemy. In damaging it, it's like, oh yeah, you look a bit like a protein, but yeah, you're not quite yet, off you go. So you get a reduced level of inflammation, and the body can start simultaneously having lower levels of inflammation from gluten
and also.
Yeah, so absolutely. And we saw those results in my studies, and I see that, and I'd seen it for so many years, and I had to go and look at it, Peter, and show the doctors and the people, the gastroenterologists and the neurologists and all of the ologists that come, that it actually works and prove it. So that's why I did the study.
What I love about what you're doing is, you know, you are so immersed in this and understand it so intuitively as well as, you know, mentally, that you are connecting the dots, that just in that little I'll call it the soliloquy that you just gave us, that you were connecting dots. It's so fast that we could barely keep up with them, but we were hearing these dots being connected. And so I wanted to remind our listeners that all of this is spelled out in Vanessa's books, the Sourdough School series of books, in which she gets into, you know, protocols for how to do this and explaining everything she just told us in much more detail, especially for those of you who are willing to go all in. Or how can they join you in the Sourdough Club in your social network?
So that's what the original question, wasn't it, Peter? So I was teaching every week, and I took it back to actually, what did I want to achieve and how was I going to do that? So we have essentially, three or four different levels of membership. So I'm just working on some short courses, which are just 12 weeks, which will be out in a few weeks. Very simple bread making for people who just want to bake a single loaf. Then we have something called a Sourdough Club membership. We have about 3,000 members on the club. And that allows you to come into a clinic. We run a clinic. That's what I'm going to do after this. I'm going to run off to the clinic. And we have a very detailed, nearly 1,000 different posts with hundreds of different recipes and video tutorials in the club. I've been building that website now for a decade, and I basically loaded my brain in there. Wow. So people can get into the club.
So if you want to see Vanessa's brain on the screen,
it's there. It's in a club.
So do they just go to sourdoughclub.com?
Sourdoughclub.com. You can get through it as well through sourdough.co.uk, or you can go to the sourdoughclub.com. We've got the social media, Peter, which is Sourdough Club, Sourdough School, and Vanessa Kimball. But we have a really beautiful community in there, and we have a forum. I have now, because of the level of people, that the speed at which the requests come through, I actually have a Californian baker actually called Sophie, who mans the decks to make sure that nobody falls over. So if there's a technical question, she's straight in there, even if I'm not.
Nice.
So it's almost like having a live support team. We're not there 24/7, but she's in America, I'm in the UK, and we between us we keep that support. There's a very tight community in there of people. But actually, it's one of those places where somebody will ask a question and I'll throw the study in that I was looking at.
Yeah.
Or I come up once a week and we just, like we're doing now, but I will have 100 people looking and chatting with me, and we generally get most of the questions done. So, and it can be as random as my bread didn't come up the way I hoped it for, down to tell me more about my microbes. I had a test and I'm low on my bifidobacterium. What do you think I should do, Vanessa? Yes. Well, so it's a beautiful club about baking in the house. And then the other courses that we do are actually both 1-year courses, Peter. They're almost like a degree course.
Yeah.
And that's when you don't just bake. You then get this half of what I do. And I actually use the case studies with a 600 strong database of studies with the doctors, bakers who actually want to explore the academic side of what I've done and apply the academic knowledge simultaneously to the baking knowledge. So we marry up the baking with the studying. Yes. And we have a diploma and a certificate. Wow. That actually marry up those. So you literally can be talking about which polyphenols are in a particular grain, and then at the weekend you'll be eating them, and you can look at the impact that they had on cholesterol, and then you can be buttering it at the weekend. So I marry the two up on the Sourdough School as a Sourdough School diploma. And then the final one, which has just come live.
There's more.
Beyond
the diploma, there's more?
No, there's one more. And that's to teach the teachers. And that is, I have had over the years people who've been here, or people who actually have said, you know what, I need to change my life. And so I train them as teachers.
Wow.
And they are they can qualify as a Sourdough School teacher. It can take it takes a while, and they have to come here and bake with me. They have to do the diploma.
Yeah.
And then I'll hold their hand as they learn to bake. And then if there's a capital I, we've actually got two Sourdough Schools opening, one in Ireland at the moment, and we've got another Sourdough School that's opening I think over towards Oxfordshire, and I've got one in Seoul at the moment, another lady in New York. Wow. So we actually then train clones of me.
Exactly. I was just going to say, we need an army of Vanessas, and now this is how you create one, you're creating teachers who can teach.
Yes,
teach
exactly. So that's the last. So that's actually, it's a big commitment, yeah. But it usually is, if you're someone is a doctor or somebody is a baker and wants to actually, you know, you've already got a lot of skill, you can then build this system on top of it and actually change the way you live your life. And teach and make a living from it. And I think that's probably the best gift of all.
Exactly. Well, before we completely run out of time, and I know you're already giving us, you know, longer than we had hoped for. So we're going to have to have you back sometime in the future, maybe after you get this doctoral work completed, and you can report back on how that all went. So we'll be calling you Dr. Vanessa at that point. But, you know, a lot of our followers and listeners are immersed in the pizza world. This is Pizza Talk and Pizza Quest. And even though our purpose is to go use pizza as sort of our guiding metaphor, is really about a search for meaningfulness in life, using pizza as our Virgil, so to speak. Why don't we close on just some thoughts you might have on how people are applying this in terms of the protocol you described to a food product like pizza. What would be a good example or a healthy way to utilize this understanding.
We have only got a couple of minutes left. So for speed, Peter, do you have the book there with each of the protocols of that core? So number one, we're going to talk about increasing fiber.
Yeah.
So if you want to read each one out to me and I'll shoot my answer back for your pizza, and then you can all apply the knowledge to your pizza. So I know number one is increasing the levels of fiber. So one of the things that you can do with your pizza is you can actually make sure that you're incorporating whole grain. And you don't have to necessarily have a 100% whole grain pizza, because we know that we like a light base. But when you subsidize some of your flour, your white flour, your white roller milled flour, you will find that it is a really good idea to increase your fiber simply by blending some of that whole grain in. So that's the first thing. Second is diversity.
Diversity, yeah.
So again, a very simple way of increasing your diversity is we keep a score. So your score on just using bread wheat would be one, and we know that we want a big score. So a nice thing might be to add a teaspoon of oregano into your pizza base. You could take a tablespoon of it out and put a tablespoon of rye in there, even small amounts of something. You could actually crush up a little bit of coriander. Put some coriander in. Then already, if you've got rye and coriander, and you know, just tiny amounts in your base, that diversity is actually, you've already lifted your score to four at that point. So play with your a tablespoon of einkorn or emmer, even the polyphenols and the balance of the flavonoids within small amounts are still feeding little tiny microbes, and you've got keeping them nourished and alive.
Sneak
a few of extra things into your flour, even small amounts. So that's another piece. What's next? Fermentation.
Ferment is the third step. And I'm going to guess here we're talking about the effect of wild natural fermentation on
absolutely. So I mean, it's very tempting to just use yeast when you come to your pizza. By including or making it a sourdough, you're including lactic acid bacteria. They have the effect of increasing acidity, and that I could go on for hours about it. Yeah. But by making it sourdough, you're going to break it down more. There's actually a benefit. We believe this is still being studied at the moment in actually the microbes themselves being digested by your microbes. And it actually delivers more nutrients from the flour, specifically B vitamins and bioavailability of fiber. So making it more nutritious.
Yeah.
So that's the next one. So longer fermentation, basically.
Just to put a little capstone on that is we're seeing in all the pizza geniuses that we've been interviewing, you know, on this site, this growing movement towards sourdough pizza making in this country, and I think probably globally. So there's been a strong movement towards flavor. Natural fermentation.
I mean, we haven't even talked about flavor. It's delicious, but of course exactly. It is.
Well,
satiating as well, so it keeps you fuller for longer, so you eat less, but keep going.
There's four more steps, but you know what? Yeah. Let me just read off these last four and direct people to the book. The book that I'm pulling this from is The Sourdough School Sweet Baking. And it's and you're going to want to have this book along with all the books. Really, they all go together. But it's right on page 30. It's somewhere around 36 or so. this page doesn't have a number.
I think it's 32.
But there's a second one. The seven powerful ways to nourish your gut microbiome, and we've gotten up to three. The next one is increased levels of antioxidants. Then the next one's increased probiots in your base.
Go a little slower. So when you're eating your pizza, the natural thing that you would think about is lycopene in the tomatoes. Okay, so we're looking at, you know, and that has been associated with lower levels of prostate cancer in Italy. I mean, it's very powerful, but you can actually lift your level of polyphenols by thinking polyphenols. What does she mean by that? Well, I mean darker vegetables and darker. It's lots of dark fruits and vegetables. So if you think about pizza, what I'd be doing here is I'd be putting aubergines on it. I'd be putting artichokes on it. I'd be loading it with some. In fact, you know, I'd be putting Olives on there, peppers. Oh my gosh. Wow. Woof. That's just, you know, the capsicums, acamantia. They are absolutely like having a party from this kind of thing. So, you know, we know, for example, that meat is, especially some of the nitrate heavy meat, like the salamis, is often, you know, we're being told bad salami, naughty salami in your bed salami. It's not good for you. But I think you have to have a balance in life. So you can offset some of the things that are naughty with some of the things that are good. And so load up your pizza with, you know, go fresh parsley. Absolutely incredible. So you're loading up diversity, you're loading up fiber, you're loading up. And then what I would do, I would absolutely artisan craft bread, artisan craft pizza deserves artisan cheese. I mean, really, are we really going to unwrap a piece of plastic, rubbish, mass-produced cheese to put on our artisan pizza? I don't bloody think so. What you need is you need to go and get something that is rude, something that is, you know, full of life, full of deliciousness, a farmer that you perhaps even know, and that connection is part of that lifestyle. I'm like, hey, the farmer that these goats that farm, his name's Bob, and he made this cheese, and what you're getting is you're getting the probiotics on there, so you can actually do it Roman style and put it on a little bit after the pizza has come out, and then you've got live.
So good cheese like that. Good cheese, maybe live cheese, raw cheese. Those are actually good for your microbiome.
Absolutely, and what I'm saying is you can make your pizza hot and bake, and then you can put the cheese on top again, and fresh figs, for example. Oh, just this is the best way to eat. Okay, what's next?
antioxidants, probiotics, again.
This is what I'm calling the probiotics. Yeah. This is putting live food with it. So if you think about this, wash it down with some kombucha, you know, beer. I mean, beer, it goes with pizza, full of polyphenols. I mean, darker the beer, the richer the liver. I mean, beer is actually good for you. And it works wonderfully. So even some of what, you know, I know sour beer, is starting to take fashion. Copenhagen, I was there a while ago with a friend. It's very big in Europe. You know, look for some craft beers, and if you can, you know, go live. The same with the wine. You can find unpasteurized wines.
Yes.
You know, there are. It is potentially you should be washing it down with something that's alive, not dead.
Exactly. There's the key point right there. Mm. And there's reduced refined sugar.
That's just so obvious. But I mean, if you were making, for example, you know, one of the books, one of the recipes in that 10-minute loaf is a chocolate and banana pizza with pistachios. Pistachios are actually very interesting, have had some really positive impacts on men's sexual health. And those, again, we look at things like this and we you know, it's funny. And my students will then throw extra pistachios on because they're like, wow, this is going to improve my sex life. Give me more chocolate, give me more flavonoids and load those pistachios. And they also have extra pistachios at that point. But actually, we're just having the evidence there that this is improving systems that are essential. You know, if you're not going to get pizza and something good and then get lucky at the end of the night, you know, you can go back to eating your store-bought pizza. I'm going for the artisan bread protocol pizza. Improve.
There's a local pizzeria here that does a Neapolitan style pizza, and their pistachio pizza is the one that made it into my next pizza book, and I have a photo of it. So in fact, and I'm, as you're saying this, I'm thinking, you know, I've got a bag of pistachios that are just...
Oh, loads more on. It has extra benefits.
All right, the final seventh step, make lifestyle changes that support the body as a whole. And I think this is it, the holistic aspect.
So the actual SADO process itself, Peter, it is a hub. It is the base upon which you can make all those things that you want to make happen. So go to the farmer's market, talk to the people whose ingredients you're using, invite those people to come and share your pizza with you. Look at actually when you're making your dough, taking that opportunity to get outside, looking at things like vitamin D, For example, I was reading a study 2 days ago showing a link between low levels of vitamin D. It's a link, not cause, but a link between low levels of vitamin D and Crohn's disease and IBD, which is very, you know, intestinal irritation is actually associated with stress. So just by de-stressing, just by making this bread central to your life, I am going to get into every corner of everything that you do, and the way it is a way of being.
Yes.
By doing this, I know that you are going to live the most beautiful and most incredible life possible. And if by doing my job and sharing this is my mission and my purpose, I think, you know, Peter, that in the end, coming back down to it and being spiritual and connecting and having that moment of going, isn't this the most beautiful day ever? You can't do that if you feel awful. If you feel ill, you can't be bothered. By feeling well, you can celebrate life. You can be spiritual. You can connect to feeling, looking after the planet, looking after each other is important, but you can't do that if you're ill, because your focus is gone. So it's about living the best life possible, because you only have one, and it's right this second.
Well, I really want to thank you for everything you just said, but also for everything that you are doing and everything that you are, because you know, your message, you know, is so important, and it resonates with so many people, and that's why the Sourdough School and the Sourdough Club, everything's growing, you know, from this central sort of image that's sort of the horse that you're riding, that's taking you into much deeper places than just a loaf of bread. And of course, I love that metaphoric journey as well. So Vanessa Kimball, thank you so much for sharing all this today. We want to get you back on Pizza Talk in a few months when you've completed that doctoral work, so we can hear how that goes. I want to advise all of our listeners to check out on the web. Just go to sourdoughclub.com. Is it Sourdough Club, Sourdough School?
It's sourdough.co.uk and the sourdoughclub.com. Peter, I'd just like to say as well, what a huge privilege, as deep as my passion runs, it's likewise in yourself. I mean, we've met, and you know, twice I think in the US, and I remember being very quiet when I met you because I was completely in awe, and I cannot believe you were interviewing me now. It's quite surreal, and I'm very grateful, and I appreciate the time that you've taken. Thank you.
Well, I think we're, you know, one of the things that we have found through your developing community and my developing is that we're all part of this one kindred spirit community, and we tend to find each other and honor each other's work. And so thank you again for all you're doing, and whatever we can do to help support that and to help lead people to the knowledge that you're willing to share. It's just so important. So Vanessa, thank you again for being with us and for giving us this extra time today. We got a whole extra segment, you know, a second show today. We'll see all of you on our next episode of Pizza Talk, brought to you by Pizza Quest. And Vanessa, have a wonderful day. Good luck on your doctoral work, and nail that thesis. And we'll see you as Dr. Vanessa Kimball the next time we talk with you.
Thank you.
Pizza Quest is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Thanks for listening.